In John chapter 1, we see the story of Andrew the disciple, and I want to simply call this message tonight Overshadowed, because truly Andrew was overshadowed by Peter. And every once in a while in the Christian life, and every once in a while even in a family, we get overshadowed by someone else in the family. I know that Levi did not want to go to Ambassador Baptist College because he didn't want to be Nathan's little brother. Now, he didn't have a problem with Nathan. He loved Nathan. Sometimes he didn't always like him, but he loved him, and they were brothers. But he said, if I go there, I know what it's going to be. He said, it's been that way all my life. I'm going to be Nathan's little brother. I'm not going to be Levi. My name is Levi. I'm not Nathan's little brother. You understand how it is. And so he was overshadowed just a mite by his older brother. And I think that's what happened with Andrew and his brother Simon. And so I want to go back and show you John the Baptist is visited by a delegation from Jerusalem. He was baptizing, preaching in his ministry out near a place called Bethabara. We're going to start in verse 19. This is the record. And this is the record of John when the Jews sent priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, who art thou? And so these priests and Levites came and asked this question. Verse 20, and he confessed and denied not, but confessed, I am not the Christ. So the first thing they want to know is, are you the Christ? He said, no. And they asked, what then? Art thou Elias? And he saith, I am not. Art thou that prophet? And that's referring to the Deuteronomy prophecy where Moses said that the Lord would send a prophet like him, and he answered no. Verse 22, then said they unto him, who art thou, that we may give an answer to them that sent us? What sayest thou of thyself? He said, I am the voice of one crying in the wilderness, make straight the way of the Lord, as said the prophet Isaiah. And they which were sent were of the Pharisees, and they asked him, and said unto him, why baptizest thou then, if thou be not that Christ, nor Elias, neither that prophet? And John answered them, saying, I baptize with water, but there standeth one among you whom ye know not. He it is who, coming after me, is preferred before me, whose shoes latchet I am not worthy to unloose. Verse 28, these things were done in Bethabara, beyond Jordan, where John was baptizing. And then we see verse 29, the next day, John seeth Jesus coming unto him and saith, behold, the Lamb of God, which taketh away the sin of the world. This is he of whom I said, after me cometh a man which is preferred before me, for he was before me. Now, that's a powerful statement. If you've never underlined that or highlighted it, you need to highlight that he was before me. Speaking of Jesus as preexistent in the heavens, for he was before me, and I knew him not, but that he should come, or that he should be made manifest to Israel. Therefore am I come baptizing with water. Verse 32, and John bare record, saying, I saw the Spirit descending from heaven like a dove, and it abode upon him. Now, is John speaking before Jesus' baptism now or afterwards? He's speaking afterwards. Do you see that? He said, I saw this. This is what I saw. I saw the Spirit descending from heaven like a dove, and it abode upon him. Matthew chapter 3 was the record of Jesus being baptized, and that's when the Spirit came down. So Matthew chapter 3 happened before John chapter 1 in verse 32. Do you see that? This has already happened. The Spirit of God has already come down upon Jesus, and he's already descended like a dove. And so now look, if you would please, at verse 34. And I saw and bear record that this is the Son of God. Again, the next day, verse 35, after John stood and two of his disciples, and looking upon Jesus as he walked, he saith, and he's speaking to these two disciples, behold the Lamb of God. And the two disciples heard him speak, and they followed Jesus. Then Jesus turned and saw them following, and saith unto them, what seek ye? And they said unto him, Rabbi, which is to say being interpreted, Master, where dwellest thou? And he saith unto them, come and see. And they came and saw where he dwelt and abode with him that day, for it was about the 10th hour. That is, it was near getting night, near dark. One of the two which heard John speak and followed him was Andrew. Now, that's one of the two. If you look down in verse 44, you see the other one was Philip. Now, Philip was of Bethsaida. You see that? So these two first disciples were Andrew and Philip. But now let's look at Andrew's situation beginning in verse 40. One of the two which heard John speak and followed him was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. He first findeth his own brother Simon and saith unto him, we have found the Messiah, which is being interpreted to Christ. And he brought him to Jesus. And when Jesus beheld him, he said, thou art Simon, the son of Jonah, which shalt be called Cephas, which is by interpretation a stone. The day following, Jesus would go forth into Galilee and findeth Philip. Now that was the other one of the two disciples. So Andrew is usually referred to in the scriptures one of two ways. He's either referred to as Peter and Andrew, his brother, or Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. But very seldom is Andrew ever just called Andrew. Almost always he has that designation of being Peter's brother. Now, I don't know if he was a little brother or an older brother or a twin brother, a younger brother. I really don't know. But I do know this. He was always called Peter's brother. Why? Because Peter kind of had the dominant personality of the two. And so he was overshadowed. I will tell you, he was a disciple of John the Baptist along with Philip prior to the time that he was a disciple of Jesus. I have to give great credit to John the Baptist, who began referring his disciples to follow Jesus. It's hard to tell your people, leave here and go follow them. Leave here and go follow him. Jesus is the Son of God. You follow him. Behold the Lamb of God. You follow him. But John was very clear about that later in John chapter 3. He said, he must increase, I must decrease. And it's hard for me to do anything but rejoice because he is the bride and or the bridegroom, and I am the bridegroom's friend. And I'm grateful that he has the bride, and I'm all for him. He must increase, I must decrease. And so John the Baptist politely stepped aside and pointed his disciples to Jesus. And so we see Andrew and Philip then began following Jesus. And if the chronological order is correct here, we might say that Andrew was the first of Jesus' disciples. He would be the first who would take up the cause and bring men to Christ. He first found Peter. His first activity was to go find Peter, his brother, and bring him to Jesus. Verse 41, we see that. And he was in the first quaternion of disciples. A lot of times we don't think about this, but Jesus' disciples were divided up into three groups of four. And those are called, we might call them quartets. Brother Fox is a musician. I'm sure he would call them a quartet. We don't have quaternions sing, but they were quaternions of disciples, and he was in the first four. There was Simon Peter, Andrew, James, and John. The second four was Philip, Bartholomew, who was the other name for Nathaniel, Thomas and Matthew. And then finally we had James, the son of Alphaeus, or he's also known as James the Less, Thaddeus, who was also known as Judas, Simon, who was also known as Zelotes, and Judas Iscariot was the last four. He was one of the confidential disciples. Now, he was not with Peter and James and John all the time. Peter, James, and John got to go into some very exclusive meetings. In Mark chapter 5 and verse 37, Peter, James, and John got to go with Jesus when Jesus raised Jairus' daughter from the dead. That was pretty special. Andrew didn't get in on that. Peter, James, and John were also with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration, Mark chapter 9 and verse 2. And Andrew didn't get involved in that. In Mark chapter 14, Peter, James, and John were the three who were invited with Jesus to go deeper into the Garden of Gethsemane the night that he was arrested. And And Andrew didn't get involved in that. But he was involved in this. Mark chapter 13 and verse 3, Peter, Andrew, James, and John were there at the Olivet Discourse. And they're the ones that asked Jesus, so when are these things going to come to pass? Pretty interesting questions that they asked there, and Jesus gave the entire Olivet Discourse in answer to their questions. Mark chapter 13 records, and as he sat upon the Mount of Olives over against the temple, Peter and James and John and Andrew asked him privately, tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign when all these things shall be fulfilled? And Jesus launched out on the Olivet Discourse, which takes up the better part of Matthew 24 and 25, and talks a lot about the tribulation period and a lot about the nation of Israel and how it is that the nation of Israel will one day be saved. And Andrew was included in that Olivet Discourse. But all in all, he was pretty much overshadowed by Peter, his brother. Peter, after all, is the one who made the brilliant confession, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. You remember Matthew chapter 16. Jesus said, whom do men say that I am? Remember that? And so, whom do men say that I am? And they said, some say thou art John the Baptist, some Elias, others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. And he saith unto them, but whom say ye that I am? Remember, it was not outspoken Andrew that answered there, but it was outspoken Peter, who spoke up and said, thou art Christ, the Son of the living God. And it was then in that same address to which Jesus said, I'm going to give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And so Andrew wasn't involved in any of that. So that brilliant confession, the mysterious keys, that was all involving Peter. It was Peter who followed afar off the night of the arrest. It was Peter who had the dubious distinction of denying Jesus three times before the cock crowed. It was Peter that had that distinction. Peter was the one of the first ones to see the resurrected Christ. Luke chapter 24 and verse 34 tells us that Jesus had appeared to Peter, and Peter had seen him. It was Peter who preached on the day of Pentecost after the ascension. It was Peter that went up to Samaria to confirm the work of Philip, and thus opening with the keys, opening the door to the Samaritans, the door of the gospel. It was Peter that went to Caesarea to deliver the gospel to Cornelius, thus again using the keys to open the door of the kingdom of heaven to the Gentiles. It was Peter who testified at Jerusalem in favor of the apostle Paul and the gospel going to the Gentiles. That was Acts chapter 15. Peter also wrote the epistles of 1st and 2nd Peter. And of course, church tradition has Peter as the first bishop of Rome and therefore the first pope of the Catholic Church. Of course, there is no historical credibility to the fact that Peter was ever even in Rome. There is credibility to the fact that he was in Babylon, but not Rome. And but Andrew didn't get, he was overshadowed by all of that. Andrew didn't preach to multitudes. As far as we know, there's no church that Andrew founded. He became a missionary, and we'll talk about that some more in a little bit. But as far as founding a specific church, we don't know of any specific churches that he found. He didn't write any epistles. He's not even mentioned in the book of Acts except as one of the remaining 11. You know, he had the distinction of not being Judas. His name was mentioned as one of the 11 apostles that remained. But other than that, he's not even mentioned in the book of Acts. And so Andrew was quite overshadowed by Peter. But I want you to understand that his service should not be diminished. And here's some reasons why as we think about Andrew this evening and apply this to our own lives. I think Andrew's service should not be diminished for the first reason, because he saw the value of an individual. Peter had the multitudes, but Andrew cared about individuals. In this text, we see that the first individual, as a matter of fact, that he cared about was his brother Peter. And how many of God's people have overlooked their own brother when it came to the gospel of Christ? I stop and think about this. If Andrew had not brought Peter to Jesus, who would have? And if Andrew had not brought Peter to Jesus, then who would have preached the day of Pentecost? And you say, well, you know, in God's sovereignty, he would have had somebody. If Andrew hadn't have done it, somebody would. Yes, that's from a divine perspective, but we don't know divine perspective. We can only deal from human perspective. And so if it's my responsibility to care for my brother, then you tell me who will if I won't. Who will care if I won't? It's not my job to say, oh, well, God knows. God will take care of it. Well, God may take care of it, but God's given me the responsibility to do it. And God had given the responsibility to Andrew to care for his brother. And how would Peter have ended up coming to Christ if Andrew had not done his job? You know, I think about Barnabas and Saul of Tarsus. After Saul of Tarsus got saved and Saul of Tarsus wanted to go up to Jerusalem, and he went up to Jerusalem, but all the people were afraid of him because they said he's persecuted Christians. We know of people that he's had put to death by his own testimony. He's had people executed, and we're afraid of him. What if he's just trying to pretend like a convert and sneak into the church so he can turn all of us over to the Jewish authorities? And who was it? It was Barnabas that went out on a limb. It was Barnabas that went out to the Apostle Paul, who was not the Apostle Paul yet. He was still Saul of Tarsus. But it was Barnabas that put his neck on the limb. It was Barnabas that went and visited with him. And it was finally Barnabas who brought Saul of Tarsus down to the apostles and to the city of Jerusalem and introduced him to the Christians there. And so can I tell you that that was one of the significant differences between Saul of Tarsus and Barnabas was the what they cared for the individual? Think about this. Andrew cared for the individual. Peter preached to the masses. He preached to the multitudes. Andrew preached to individuals. He was concerned about the individual. That was kind of the difference between Saul of Tarsus and Barnabas too. Remember, Barnabas was the one who said, you know, he quit the first time. I know we went on that first missionary journey and John Mark got cold feet and he went back. For whatever reason, he quit, but I think we should give him another chance. I think we should work with him. I know he's just one. I know he's just an individual guy. And Saul of Tarsus, who now is the Apostle Paul, said, yes, but he failed the mission. And the mission is more important than any man. Is there a sense in which Paul is correct? The ministry of the gospel, is that in fact not more important than the feelings of one man? Well, I suppose maybe it is. But I'm glad there are some Barnabases that care about one man. I'm glad there are some Barnabases that said, we need to give John Mark another try. I wonder, was there somebody who gave you another try? Think about it. When you were young in the faith, did you not commit some boo-boos along the way? And did not God send somebody along who cared about you and who individually lifted you up and who individually pointed you in the right direction and who gave you individual attention and individual care at some really defining moment in your life? I know there was in my life. I thank the Lord that God sent some people into my life who cared about the individual. And Barnabas cared about the individual. Andrew cared about the individual. I think that's an important thing. So we need to see that he saw the value of the individual. He's the one that brought the lad to Christ. One lad, but you know what that made him? He was really the church's first foreign mission or first home missionary. And then he brought the Greek men to Jesus in John chapter 12. The Greeks came and said, sirs, we would see Christ. And it was Andrew who actually made the introduction. They came to Philip first. Philip didn't know quite what to do, so he brought them to Andrew. And it was Andrew that said, come here, meet Jesus. So he became the church's first foreign missionary because he cared about one guy. So he saw the value of the individual. Can I say that you and I, as believers, need to care about the individual? I've seen a lot of times in church work, we want to put everything in a class. We have new believers, and we want to disciple them all at once, and we want to herd them up like cattle and teach them all to be baptized and teach them all to read their Bible and teach them all to pray, and so we have a new converts class. But can I tell you, every new convert comes to Christ from a different place. They all have different baggage. They've come from different experiences, and they need some individual attention. A class may work in some circumstances, but can I tell you, most people need some individual attention. And Andrew saw that. And so he brought the lad to Jesus. He brought the Greeks. Here's the second thing I see that he realized. He saw the value of the insignificant. Look with me in John chapter 6, if you would, please. We're in John 1 now. Flip over to John 6, just a few chapters later in the book of John. And we see in verse 5, when Jesus lifted up his eyes and saw a great company come unto him, he saith unto Philip, whence shall we buy bread that these may eat? And this he said to prove him, for he himself knew what he would do. Now, Jesus asked the question here that he already knew the answer to, but he was testing his disciples. Does the Lord ever test you? Does the Lord ever test me? I think he does. I think sometimes he puts us in a tight spot just to see what we'll do. It isn't that he's lost control of the situation. I think he's full well aware of what's taking place, and he already knows where provision is going to come from. But he puts us in that spot to see what we will do. And so Philip answered him, 200 penny worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may take a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, saith unto him, there's a lad here which hath 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes, but what are they among so many? And Jesus said, make the men sit down. And then you remember the story, how he multiplied the loaves and the fishes and fed the multitude. But what I want you to see here is that they had 200, and the Greek word is denarii. They had 200 denarii in the treasury. 1 denarii was a day's wage. 200 denarii would have been about 8 months' wage. But we're told in other places that this was 5,000 men and their families. So there's about 20,000 people to feed here. And that wasn't really sufficient. Even if there had been a Walmart down the road, how many times does Walmart have enough food in stock to feed 20,000 people? I mean, that would tax a dozen Walmarts if that happened to be. And so Philip knew that human means would be insufficient. And you see that in verse 6. He says, that's not enough that even everyone may take a little. But Andrew did his best to obey. Andrew knew that anything placed in Jesus' hand gained value. Whatever is placed in Jesus' hand gains value. And I remember how it was that Ananias and Sapphira started out. They said, you know, Barnabas sold a piece of ground and gave the money to the poor through the church, and he got much praise for it. And Ananias and Sapphira said, we'd like a little of that praise, so we have a piece of property we'll sell. Well, let me tell you, as soon as you give a piece of property to Jesus, it's going to gain in value. And so what happened was the property evidently gained in value, so they didn't give all the price of it to the church after they had made the promise. They learned that what you put in Jesus' hand gains in value. And it is true. And Andrew understood that. Anything that you place in his hand gains value. Now listen, the bread was barley loaves. That's a poor man's fare. Barley is worth much less than wheat. And the fish were small. Maybe they were just sardines, but they were small. But Andrew did his best to obey. You know what he did? He identified the only available food source and put it in Jesus' hands, and the rest was up to Jesus. And sometimes that's what you and I have to do. We have to identify a source, put it in Jesus' hands, and say, now, Lord, I've done all I can do. I put this in your hands. It's up to you. Later, Jesus taught the disciples in Luke chapter 21. That's the story of the widow's mite, that the value of the gift is not determined by the size of the gift. Look back at Luke 21, if you would, please. I want you to see this. I think it's a pretty important lesson. Luke chapter 21 and verse 1. Take a moment and turn back there. Luke chapter 21 and verse 1, and he looked up and saw the rich men casting their gifts into the treasury. And he saw also a certain poor widow casting in thither two mites. Now a mite was the smallest coin that a Jew could have. She cast in two of the smallest valued coins that she had. And he said, of a truth, I say unto you that this poor widow hath cast in more than they all. Now notice this, he saw rich men casting their gifts, plural, into the treasury. They were giving much, and they were rich men, so they were giving of their abundance. But this poor widow, he says, she's given more than they all. Verse 4 is the killer. For all these have of their abundance cast in unto the offerings of God, but she of her penury hath cast in all the living that she had. She gave it all. Now they gave of their abundance, meaning that after they had given, they had much left over. But she gave everything. And even though the dollar value of her gift was less than theirs, Jesus said she, in fact, gave more than they did. So the value of a gift is not determined by its size. So we see that Andrew saw the value of an individual. He saw the value of the insignificant. He saw the value of inconspicuous service. Look at John chapter 12. If you would, John chapter 12, just a few pages over from where you were in John chapter 6. John chapter 12 and verse 20, and there were certain Greeks among them that came up to worship at the feast. The same came thereof to Philip, which was of Bethsaida of Galilee, and desired him, saying, Sir, we would see Jesus. Now this is interesting to me. And Philip cometh and telleth Andrew, and again Andrew and Philip tell Jesus. It's kind of like Philip didn't want to go to Jesus by himself with these Greeks. I'm not sure why that was. But he knew Andrew will know what to do. And so he went to Andrew, and between Andrew and Philip, they tell Jesus. And so it's a significant thing here. It's an inconspicuous service. I mean, he served the Lord in a really inconspicuous way. But what I want you to see here is that he was more concerned about bringing people to Jesus than who got the credit for it. I said one time to a friend of mine, I said, I'd like you to take a certain bus route. And he said, which one is it? And I described it to him. This was when I was still in North Chicago. And you know what he said? What's in it for me? I never heard of anybody wondering about serving the Lord, about taking a Sunday school class or a church bus route or anything like that and asking what's in it for me, as though there's ever anything in it for me. As far as I'm concerned, there's nothing in it for me. This is service to the Lord. But what's in it for me, he asked. And I see here that Andrew was not interested in who got the credit. It didn't matter to him. He was known among the disciples as the one who could introduce people to Jesus. And so these men came to Philip, and Philip went to Andrew because Andrew would know where Jesus was, and he would make the introduction. He was not among those who ambitiously vied for position among the disciples. We are led to believe that that would be Peter, James, and John, and who knows who else, but we've never been hinted that Andrew was among those who vied for position. He was not among those who boasted of their loyalty nor their intentions to sacrifice their lives. He was just one who served behind the shadows. He saw the value of intimate interviews with Jesus. Mark chapter 13 and verse 3, when he and Peter and Andrew or Peter and James and John were outside the temple, and they asked about when are these things going to happen? When are you going to come again? When is the kingdom going to happen? And what will be the signs of your coming? And they had this whole long intimate interview with Jesus. You know, a lot of folks have known Jesus for years and have really never gotten intimate with him, never telling him the deepest desires of their hearts. Through the years, I've known a lot of people involved in marriage situations who have loved their spouse, and they have had children, and they have been intimate with each other in a physical kind of way, but they've never really been able to open up the deepest secrets of their heart and share with each other. What is making them afraid? I ask you as a husband and wife this evening, have you talked to each other about your fears? What is it you fear? I've told you this before, how I said, well, my wife is not afraid of me dying and leaving her alone. This is many years ago. I was not even 30 yet. And I asked her, are you afraid of me dying? And she said, yeah, I'm afraid of you dying. Who would marry me and help me raise these four little kids? I had no idea what was going on in her head. I still think there's days when I have no idea what's going on in her head. Do you understand? We can be pretty intimate without scratching the surface. Intimacy is when you say, you know, I was tempted today. I was afraid today. I had this feeling go through my heart today. That's true intimacy. And a lot of people have been married for many years. Well, let me take it out of the realm of marriage and take it into the realm of salvation. A lot of people have been saved for years and they've never really been intimate with the Lord Jesus in their prayer life. Now, the good part of that is you really don't have to be, because he knows it all anyway. You say, well, I don't have to share things with him. He's omniscient. He knows anyway. Yeah, but don't you think he'd like to hear it from your lips? Supposing I was just a really good guesser and could guess what my wife was thinking, I'd still like to hear her say it. You know, I've heard people say, oh, my husband doesn't say he loves me very much, but I know he does, because he keeps trudging off to work every day and he keeps coming home every night. And he keeps bringing the paycheck home, so I know he loves me, he just doesn't ever say it very much. Well, wouldn't you like to hear him say it some? You heard about the guy that married his wife, and they'd been married several years. And she said, why don't you ever tell me you love me anymore? And he said, I told you when we married that I loved you. If I ever change my mind, I'll let you know. Now, that's just not very romantic, fellas. Ladies like to hear it a little more often than that. And even if they know it, they still like to hear it. And I can tell you that even though the Lord in his omniscience knows what's going on in our heart and life and mind, I can tell you that he'd still like to hear it. He'd like us to be intimate with him. And I see Andrew having that intimacy with Jesus. Tradition tells us that Andrew carried the gospel into the north country as far as Scythia, and he became the patron saint in years to come of Russia and Scotland. It's believed that he carried the gospel into those places as far as the extent of his missionary work went. It was recorded that he was crucified on an X-shaped cross, and that he was lashed instead of nailed to make the suffering last longer. But it backfired on the people who were executing him, because they had lashed him instead of nailing him. He was able to preach for two full days before he died from his cross. And tradition records that. Andrew proves that It is the little things that really count. It is the little people. And I think about Elijah when he was fleeing from Jezebel. Who was it that fed him? It was just a widow lady and her son. And remember, he was fed even by smaller things than the widow lady before that. Remember, he was fed by a raven for a long time by a brook. And then the brook dried up, and the Lord said, well, go down to Zarephath, and there's a widow lady there that will sustain thee. And he went and he saw the widow, and the widow said, he said, would you give me something to eat? And she said, sir, I've just got like a cup of meal and a small cruse of oil, and I'm getting ready to make a biscuit for me and my son, and when we eat that, we're going to die. And Elijah said, well, feed me first, and everything will be all right. And so she made the biscuit and gave it to him, and she looked in the barrel, and guess what? There was more meal and more oil. And every time she kept going back to that barrel, there was more meal and more oil. And the Lord used that simple little widow lady to feed Elijah during that famine. And I think Andrew shows us that the Lord uses little things, little people. He can use little people. He can use little gifts. The lad's lunch, just cheap bread and two little fishes. Probably they were sardines. Probably they were really strong. That's probably how Andrew was able to locate the meal, as he could smell the sardines. I hate sometimes. I eat sardines for lunch sometimes, and I always rinse the cans out, because one day I didn't do that. I ate the sardines and threw the can in the trash, and people came in, and they'd walk in the kitchen and say, ooh, what is that? Well, it's sardines. I had them for lunch on Monday, but see, it was Thursday or Friday, and by Thursday or Friday, they were pretty rank. And so probably Andrew says, I smell sardines. Somebody around here has some sardines, and he found the boy with the little lunch. Can I tell you, little people, little gifts, I think a little service. One of my favorite stories is back in 2 Kings chapter 7 when the Syrians had besieged the city of Samaria. You remember that? That for several weeks they let nobody in and nobody out, and people were dying, and people were like killing jackasses and eating the meat off the skull. I mean, it was really down to, they were eating bad stuff and dead stuff and awful stuff, and it was terrible. And there were four lepers outside the city of Samaria, and they said, well, if we went inside the city, if we could get in there, there's nothing in there to eat. We'd just starve to death just like them, and we'd be lucky if they didn't kill us because we're lepers. But they said, you know, we might go to the Syrian camp, and they may kill us because we're lepers, but if they feed us, what if they feed us? If they feed us, we've lived a day longer. So they went down to the Syrian camp, and they got there and found out that the Lord had let them hear like chariot wheels the night before, and they had all took off running because they thought the king of Egypt was coming with a huge army, and they abandoned their gold and silver and tents, and the tents were all full of food, and a lot of it was already cooked, and those lepers went in and ate and filled their bellies and loaded their pockets up, and the Bible says they made a trip out with gold and came back for more. And then one of the guys said, we do not well. We do not well. If we tarry till the morning light, some mischief will come upon us. Now therefore come that we may go and tell the king's household. We'd better go share this good news. And so they went and told the people inside the city of Samaria, the Syrians are all gone. They've abandoned their camp and there's food aplenty. And you know what the king said? He says, this on the word of four lepers. It's probably a trap. And so he sent some people along, and guess what? He found out sure as the world. And those Syrians had left in such a hurry, they were throwing clothes and food and gold and silver. They were just strewing it in the path as they ran away. And they went in, and everybody in the city was able to eat because those four lepers did that small service of going and telling what they had found. You know, it may not be a big service you do somebody, but if you found relief for the sin of your soul, and you go share that with somebody, I'm telling you, you may not think a lot of people out there are really interested in having their sins forgiven and being reconciled to God, but there are some people out there that would love to be forgiven and have their soul saved and be right with God. There are some people. You just got to find out who they are. You got to tell enough people, and somebody will say, man, it's that simple? You're kidding me. I can be saved? You're serious. I can have my sins forgiven. I can be right with God. Yes, and it's not a large service. It's just a small thing. But you can do it. You can do it if you would. God uses little people, little gifts, little service. He uses little things. Remember, it was just a smooth stone. But you pick a smooth stone up out of the brook and put it in the right sling and you can kill Goliath. If you got the right stone and the right sling and the right hand, the giant can be slain. God doesn't need much. He uses little things. God thrives on using little things to make big differences. Yes, Andrew lived in the shadow of Peter. Peter achieved great things. And Andrew never could overcome his shadow. All of his life, he was still known as Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, or Peter's brother, Andrew. He was always known that way. Peter preached to the multitudes. Peter presided over the apostles. Peter wrote epistles. But can I tell you, without Andrew, there may not have been a Peter in the New Testament church. You ever heard of John Staupitz? Most people have never heard of John Staupitz. He's the guy who led Martin Luther to Jesus Christ. Thomas Bilney. Who is Thomas Bilney? Well, he led Hugh Latimer to Christ. He was one of the martyrs in Great Britain as the light of the gospel was beginning to dawn. Who was John Eglin? John Eglin is the dear saint that led Charles Haddon Spurgeon to Jesus Christ as a teenage boy. Who was Edward Kimball? You say, isn't he the guy that was looking for the one-armed man? No, that was a different Kimball. That was a different Kimball. That was Richard Kimball. Who was Edward Kimball? Well, Edward Kimball led D.L. Moody to Christ. And I was telling Brother Fox earlier this week, on Tuesdays, we read as many days as we can, and we were reading about the history of modern revivalism, and we've been reading about D.L. Moody and some of the men that followed him, and I found the details on this story, so I close with this little story. Kimball led D.L. Moody to Christ in 1858. In 1879, in England, Moody awakened evangelistic zeal in F.B. Meyer. Later, F.B. Meyer came to the United States and preached in an American college campus, and in that service, J. Wilbur Chapman got saved, and J. Wilbur Chapman was engaged then in WMCA work, and he employed a young evangelist by the name of Billy Sunday to do evangelistic work. Billy Sunday later became an evangelist in his own right and went to a revival meeting in Charlotte, North Carolina, and had such a powerful crusade that a local group of businessmen said, we've got to do that again. And so they couldn't get Sunday, but they got a guy by the name of Mordecai Ham to come to Charlotte, North Carolina for a crusade. And it was in that crusade with Mordecai Ham that a young man by the name of Billy Graham walked the aisle and received Jesus Christ as his Lord and Savior. Between 1947 and 1977, Billy Graham and associates reportedly preached to 54 million people with over 1.6 million decisions recorded. And that all started with one Sunday school teacher in 1858 and he chewed his fingernails down to the quick before getting enough courage to go in and talk to this young shoe salesman about the need of his soul. You never know. You never know where the gospel seed might land when you sow it. It's the little things that count. It's the little things. And Andrew shows us that truly a cup of water given in Jesus' name is never overshadowed or unimportant. It might just be a cup of water that tips the scale for somebody's heart to soften enough to listen to the gospel, and that could change everything. Would you be used of God to do a small thing in a small way that the Lord of glory might be lifted up and exalted? I hope you will. Would you bow your heads for prayer, please?